This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
There was a time of persecution. And then after that, he went to different places. He went to Ta'if, which is a place outside of Mecca. He went to Al-Aws wal-Khazraj, who are two clans, two tribes. And what it was is that he was trying to get support for his project, or the monotheistic project, because he was being boycotted, etc. He eventually got it from Al-Aws wal-Khazraj, these two tribes, because they actually believed in the religion of Islam. This is documented, like, without a shadow of a doubt. This is what happened. And then they
is this in the Medina? Is this the Medina period that you're speaking of?
So this is actually technically the Meccan period.
Okay, still the Meccan period.
Yeah, so right before Medina literally was established, because Medina is it was so called after the Prophet, because Medina just literally means the city in Arabic. It was called Yathrib before, and then they changed it into Medina to Nabi, like the city of the Prophet. And so that's why it was kind of called Medina after that. In that time period, so you've got 13 years of Medina. The vast majority, I'm not going to say all, but the vast majority of wars that took place, in fact, all of the wars that took place before the conquest of Mecca were defensive. So the pagan Arabs went to Medina and tried to siege it. Badr, Uhud, Ahzab, or the Khandaq, and all of these are names of wars. And in fact, there was, according to Ibn Qayyim, one scholar, there were 19 such wars in 10 years. So that's almost an average of two wars every year. And for me, I see that actually as an evidence for prophethood, because the Prophet was actually fighting in these wars. He wasn't just throwing people around telling him to fight for him. He was fighting in them, and they were defensive wars. So in that time period, what happened was, I'll give you one example.
So let me interject something there, because that's a very hard thing for me to get straight in my mind.
Yes.
Now, I would say that, and the division in Islam that occurred almost immediately upon Muhammad's death, and which has not been rectified to this day, quite the contrary. So that's also, that's a problem for everyone. Yeah. It's a problem for Muslims. It's a problem for Christians. It's a problem for everyone. And it's a problem that could really get out of hand. Now, it's not like I don't know that the Protestants and the Catholics were at each other's throats for, hundreds of years. So, but that's not the issue at the moment. So now, In Islam, there's a tremendous emphasis on Christ's doctrines as well. And there isn't any evidence that Christ himself took part in, let's say, wars.
Okay, I disagree with that.
Let me disagree with that. What do you mean?
Okay, well, if you analyze Christ as an archetype, when he comes back in his second coming, he is going to dominate the world. And one can say, well, that's not the historical Christ. But when we're looking at him, in the way that you look at...
Look, that's a reasonable objection. I understand that a judge has that martial element. And I don't think it's reasonable to use the archetypal representation as an argument against the historical reality. And look, I'm not saying to you that I know that what Muhammad did was wrong. That isn't what I'm saying. I'm saying that I don't understand how participation in those defensive wars, let's say, but then that was also followed by a tremendous explosion of Islamic expansion, right? The biggest empire the world had ever seen in a very short period of time, right at Europe's doors. Mm-hmm. And that was also followed by the severance of the Islamic faith into two major categories and internecine conflict there. Yes. And so there's that stream of armed conflict activity.
I don't think you're getting the history fully right here, because
That's fine. Go right ahead.
The war in Jamal and Safin, the wars between Shia and Sunnah, or what would then be, it's not really between Shia and Sunnah, because quite frankly, Shiaism had not been established as a, but the wars of the companions, how many people died in those wars? Do we have any numbers? For maximum, we can say...
Fair enough, man. And it's not like Christianity hasn't been rife with internecine conflict.
But
the fact is that it was almost immediately after Muhammad's death that this fracturing took place among the people that were closely allied with him. And it was a bloody fracturing. And it isn't obvious that it's been rectified.
How bloody was it? How bloody was it?
How bloody does it have to be? It doesn't take much.
Let's be honest. Let's be fair. Let's be fair, right? With the wars that took place 30 to 40 years, and it wasn't immediately after, because you said that in a video, the day he died, that's wrong. It didn't happen the day he died. It happened 30 to 40 years after.
And how many members of Muhammad's immediate family survived during that 30 years? My understanding was that most of his immediate family died in armed conflict.
Most of his immediate family died in his own lifetime.
Yes. Well, I'm not speaking of them, but I'm speaking of what happened after he died.
Get these facts right, because...
Yeah.
Okay, look. First fact. Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, we say sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, meaning peace and blessings be upon him. All of his children died in his life, okay, except for one. So most of the members of his immediate family, and his wife died, Khadija died, his uncle Abu Talib died, his other uncle Hamza died, they all died within his lifetime, either due to illness or due to some other cause, war, for example. Like one of the defensive wars, Hamza died. And by the way, Muhammad forgave his killer. And that's something which goes against the warlord thesis, because when he then conquered Mecca, it was actually no fighting. I'm not sure if you know this. It's called Fathu Mecca. When he went into and conquered Mecca, he didn't fight anybody. It was no fighting. There were a few people that were exempted, but he actually quoted what Joseph quoted to his brothers in the Quran, which is La tathriba alaykum al-yawm, that no blame is on you today. And this, by the way, is a bedrock example of forgiveness in Islam, because these were people that were persecuting him for 13 years. These are people that killed his uncle. Like I said, there's one person called Wahshi who literally killed his uncle and mutilated his body. And he said to Wahshi, "I forgive you, but I can't see your face because of how he said, "Mumkin tughayyib anni wajhak wa wajhak anni." He said, "Can you keep your face away from me? Because I can't, psychologically, I can't bring my face, but I do forgive you," he said. So he forgave people that killed his own family members. And this was after he himself attempted a treaty with the pagans called Hudaybiyah. And so they broke the treaty, and that's what initiated the conquest of Mecca, which was not a conquest, that was a fighting. Now, if you compare this, because I think the comparison, if there's any comparison that can be or should be made, it's Jesus' second coming with Muhammad in the Medinan period, not in the Meccan period. In the Meccan period, both were being persecuted, Jesus in his life and Muhammad in the Meccan period. But Jesus, when he comes back, he will then get authority, and he will be ruling with the iron scepter, according to the Bible. He will be crushing his enemies, as it says in Corinthians, under his foot, humbling his enemies under his foot, and killing in violent stuff. So in fact, I will actually argue today that the New Testament representation of Jesus Christ in his second coming is way more violent than Muhammad's conquests in the Medinan period.
Okay, well, look, like I said, I wasn't trying to make the case. I wasn't trying to make the case that what happened in Mecca or Medina was wrong. Like, so let me explain that a little bit. So Christian Europe fought a defensive war against the Nazis. It isn't obvious that that was wrong.
I don't think that was... I wouldn't say that's defensive.
Well, okay, fine. But I understand the concept of defensive war.
When America got involved in World War II, it was not under immediate threat by Germany. And they colonized it. And here's the thing. It overtook Western Germany, you see. And here's the thing. The term warlord that you use with the Prophet, you've never used with Harry Truman. You've never used with Roosevelt. You've never used with Winston Churchill, all of which conquered countries, literally, in wars. Because I feel like there is a bias there. And you've actually never used it with anybody else aside from the Prophet Muhammad in your public output. And I think that's unjustifiable. I think that you have biblical prophets like Moses. You have biblical prophets like Joshua. You have the Jesus in his second coming, all of which were warrior prophets, and you've only used the term warlord with the Prophet Muhammad, and I think that is unjustifiable. I think what makes someone a warlord if it's conquering lands, then Harry Truman is a warlord, then and so on and so forth. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad...
Well, I guess that's a real tough question, isn't it? What makes a warlord and what makes a just war? It's not like any of us have the precise answers to that.
We're trying to hash out right here. Definitions of the word warlords. The definition of the word warlord, according to Collins, is that someone who acquires force by aggressivity and violence.
Well, you pushed back on me, so I'll push back on you to some degree.
Okay.
Well, it's certainly the case that the expansion of the Islamic Empire was accomplished by a tremendous amount of warlike activity, and that wasn't defensive. Now, look, I understand that monotheism is a difficult state to attain, and that monotheistic societies have emerged in the midst of conflict throughout human society. I understand that, and I'm not even saying that there's something exceptional in that regard about Islam, although the rate at which it happened was quite remarkable. But it still, it presents us with a problem, doesn't it? I mean, everyone, it presents everyone with a problem. And the problem is, well, for example, the problem is reconciling the idea of turning the other cheek with the idea of a just war, a defensive war, or an expansive war for that matter. And of course that issue is relevant to Islam because Islam exploded outward and produced the biggest empire the world had ever seen in the space of a few short centuries.
Yeah, but so, Dr. Jordan Peterson.
So then you ask, well, what's the spirit? What is the spirit that animated that? And is that attributable to the Islamic doctrines themselves?
Yes,
I don't know the
be.
Answer to that.
Now, let me tell you the answer to that, okay? And this is what I want to tell you conclusively, and this will help build bridges, honestly. Because we can maintain the warlord thesis, we can maintain the expansionist thesis. But here's what I'll tell you. Islam has a capability to be expansive, and it also has a capability of making peace treaties. And it does, and it should do, whatever's in its best interest. Just like every country should do whatever's in its best interest. In the pre-modern world, we did not, I think this is highly anachronistic. In the pre-modern world, there was no such thing as the UN. It was a realist international relations framework whereby everybody was fighting everyone. The Roman Empire didn't care about it didn't care about you, quite frankly. It was expanding itself. The Persian Empire was expanding itself. And the Arabian Peninsula was in between both. And so it could have either been swallowed by those two other empires, or it could decide to, in fact, we will impose our government on them before they impose it on us. And it decided the former rather than the latter. It decided to expand. And in fact, the Prophet, in his weakest of times, he predicted that that would happen. You know, there was one war in particular where they were starving, and it's called Khandaq. And he hit a rock and he said, Futihat Rum, the Roman Empire has been conquered. He hit another rock again. And he said, Futihat Faris, that the Persian Empire has been conquered. And then he knocked the rock again. He said this in his weakest moment. He said that the Yemen has been conquered. I see that the expansion of the Islamic Empire is a proof for Islam. And you know, it's not just me. Even historians say this. Barnaby Rogerson, he said the fact that Islam spread to the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire is equivalent to equivalent to Eskimos taking over Russia and America. I believe it's miraculous, if anything, that this happened. But I don't think it's unjustifiable. I think actually, Jordan Peterson, to be
then
completely
honest
with you,
why did it stop at Europe's borders, so to speak? If it was a miraculous expansion,
it stopped out because of it wasn't successful there. It wasn't. It stopped where it couldn't go further. But the point is that it's not like the Christians at that time in Rome cared. I mean, they did the same thing for years. They were expanding themselves.
Well, that's why I said I wasn't making a prima facie case that this was wrong. I'm trying to understand it. And so, and you objected to my use of the term warlord, and perhaps rightly so. You know, perhaps that was an injudicious comment. I was rather shocked when I was reading Islamic history, when I encountered the degree of violence that surrounded these events. And so, you know, maybe I was in, like
no,
I said, I was
injudicious.
I appreciate
what you said there. I think that shows real sincerity in it. And it's one step closer to creating real meaningful relationships between.
I think your defense that, well, the world was a battleground of empires. And, you know, if it's push out from our territory or being encroached upon and dominated, then it isn't obvious that being encroached upon and dominated is the right approach, the correct approach, the most moral approach, let's say, especially because there'd be no shortage of bloodshed that would also accompany that. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're in a bad place. But, you know, it's not an easy thing for any of us to, what would you say, mediate between doctrines like turn the other cheek and love your enemy, and also at the same time discuss the necessity of both defensive and sometimes expansionist wars, right? We all have to contend with that. And it's very difficult to contend with it. The arguments are extremely complicated.
You're absolutely right. And I